You often hear that we live in an increasingly secular society. But what exactly is a secular society? One of the pillars of such a society, argues Dr. Christopher Watkin, who specializes in contemporary Western and European thought, is that such a society, quote, has plausibility structures that make disbelief in the God of the Bible seem natural and obvious, end quote. Watkin cites philosopher Leslie Newbegin, who observes that the dominant plausibility structure of our time is the belief that, quote, there is no socially accepted plausibility structure, and thus we make our own choices, end quote. Newbegin also notes that within this belief is the added assumption that there are what culture considers to be public facts, usually endorsed by the sciences, which are distinct and separate from, quote, the world of beliefs, opinions, and values, end quote. A secular society shifts God from the category of public facts into the private and subjective realm of personal opinion and belief. But the idea that God does not exist or is no longer relevant is not finally something that can be established as a scientific fact. As human beings, we are imaginative interpreters of the world we inhabit. Our perceptions are shaped in part by our imagination. Secular societies imagined alternatives to a robust theological view of the world, however, suffer from a lack of imagination, often merely looking to government to provide solutions for the moral and social problems we face today. But this idea has not exactly turned out the way it has often been promised. As Watkin observes, quote, the vague and sporadic measures taken by contemporary governments to shore up the social contract with well-meaning but half-hearted attempts at civil education have little effect, when all the while billions of advertising dollars and a destructive paradigm of competition in all areas of society expertly catechize individual consumers to be little predisposed to the civic duties a strong social contract requires. No rewriting of the social contract can be complete without giving serious attention to its cultural and liturgical infrastructure, end quote. This comes from Watkin's recent book, Biblical Critical Theory: How the Bible's Unfolding Story Makes Sense of Modern Life and Culture. It is a rich exploration of how the Bible remains relevant for our time. It also provides the necessary and prescient wisdom for us in negotiating our way through a burgeoning secular society. While Watkin is not specifically advocating for formal Christian apologetics per se, his work is nonetheless a rich and hopeful defense of the Christian faith for our time. The exploration of what Watkin calls our liturgical infrastructure, for example, requires us to be willing to understand the times in which we live, just as the sons of Issachar did in David's time. 1 Chronicles 12:32 tells us that these sons possessed, quote, knowledge of what Israel should do, end quote. The notion of contextualizing the gospel message, however, for our culture and time generates a lot of debate and discussion. The Apostle Paul, for example, contextualized his message to the Athenians on Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17, using some of their idols and poets as a means of introducing the resurrection of Jesus and a call to repentance to them. Some argue that it is not necessary to contextualize the gospel, but simply to know the scriptures and proclaim the gospel. There is no one-size-fits-all method for how to reach our culture or our non-believing neighbors. Apologetics methods are quite varied. There are different schools of apologetics: cultural, presuppositional, classic, evidential, and reform, just to name a few of the prominent ones. And as a staff apologist here at Watchman Fellowship, I find there is good in each of them, and I often find myself applying different approaches in different contexts, depending on my audience. Whether it is a church in southwest Oklahoma, a Muslim student at the University of Texas in Dallas, an atheist book club here in DFW, a Mormon in Utah, or a Jehovah's Witness at the airport, I find it essential to know something about the people with whom I am speaking in order to know how I might wisely employ biblical truth in our conversations. Initially, as I've discovered slowly but painfully, that involves much more listening than speaking. If my goal is merely to win the argument, then I will only be a clanging cymbal, as the Apostle Paul says, listening merely for opportunities to railroad my interlocutor with what I think are clever gotcha arguments. If I do that, I will only end up turning people away, and sadly, I have done that. But if my goal is a relationship, or if I'm laboring with patience and the necessary love of which Paul speaks in 1 Corinthians 13, then the outcomes are often quite different. But even as one who earns his living from apologetics, I, like the Apostle Paul, have by no means perfected my approaches, but I press on, stumbling through my tendencies to still play gotcha with non-believers at times. The good that I want to do, I do not always do. It is often a rather messy endeavor, apologetics is. Personal sanctification and character refinement is a slow and laborious process, but one that includes denying ourselves for the sake of others. And part of that includes listening attentively and trying to understand the other person. Recently, I was exhorted and encouraged in my own apologetic labors by our guest this week and next on the profile, author and professor of theology at Dort University, Dr. Justin Bailey. We talked about his 2020 book, Reimagining Apologetics, The Beauty of Faith in a Secular Age. Having completed a master's degree in cultural apologetics in 2016, I found a lot of agreement with what Justin advocates. Justin argues that apologetics today requires the wise and compassionate use of both reason and imagination. He argues that we do need to understand the liturgical infrastructure of our culture today in order to effectively reach those who might be, as the Apostle Paul put it in Athens, groping for God. In Bailey's more holistic approach, we are able to reimagine and even re-examine our own assumptions. We can know our audience more authentically and avoid the modernist traps of thinking of ourselves as mere logic and information machines. Justin reminds us that apologetics isn't just purely distilled logic and reason, nor is it a list of facts or arguments, but apologetics is an entire way of life. It includes the mind, the soul, the moral character of the apologist, logic, reason, and the aesthetic components of reality, beauty, creativity, and the imagination. How we combine and apply all of these in our apologetic efforts to make belief in God more plausible again will be different for each one of us. Here on part one, I ask Justin to define his concept of the imagination and how he sees the role of the imagination in apologetics today. Here is Dr. Justin Bailey.
When I talk about the imagination, I'm primarily interested in this created and creative human faculty that God has given to humanity that allows us to explore possibility. So it's strategic. We imagine because we do that. It's a mode of perception or a mode of thinking, a mode of being in the world that accomplishes something that other modes of thinking don't. So it's strategic, it's intentional, it's directed towards something, meaning that I can't just imagine in general, right? I have to point my imagination in a direction or be captivated by something. So it sort of is always going to be pointed in a particular direction. And it is the faculty with which we sort of are able to suspend actuality in order to explore possibility. And there are both just ordinary everyday uses of the imagination where you don't have some knowledge and your imagination fills in the gaps. So for example, you hear something in the bushes and your imagination fills in, you know, what that might be possibly. And so that's a very everyday use of the imagination. And then there's also very intensive uses of the imagination whereby people are very creative and create alternative worlds for us to inhabit, for example, in a play or a novel or a movie or a television show. And so you have everywhere, you're using the imagination in your just basic being in the world to explore possibilities and possible ways of being in the world. And the reason why it obviously matters for apologetics is because, especially if you're talking to someone who is not in a position of faith, who doesn't find faith compelling or believable, in order for them to even move in that direction, they're going to have to open themselves to the possibility, right? To even be able to hear the argument. If a person thinks, for example, like a Richard Dawkins, that a Christian faith is just laughable, it's not even worth taking seriously, and I don't even want to hear the argument, then you're not going to get very far no matter what arguments you bring to them.
Sure.
So the imagination is really that faculty that allows us to cast a vision for others that they can inhabit and take up, so that we can think about what would make a belief believable. So it's not in any way opposed to the traditional way of doing apologetics, but hopefully it's a bit more holistic and a bit truer to the way that God's created us as human beings to be in the world.
Okay, very helpful. And it reminds me of something that Lewis did say in his last published work, The Discarded Image. And he's, of course, talking about the medieval model of the cosmos in this work. And I credit Michael Ward for helping me unpack the insights that are in that book. It's a fascinating read and probably one of Lewis's most neglected books that people don't read or don't know about, but it's fantastic. But in that book, he says, and a quote here, on the imaginative and emotional level, Lewis says, it makes a great difference whether with the medievals we project upon the universe our strivings and desires, or with the moderns our police system and our traffic laws or traffic regulations. And so Lewis is setting up this idea that his love of the medieval model was not necessarily because it was true, scientifically speaking, but because it had everything to its place, and its place, everything had a place and everything had a purpose. And there was a teleology, a structured layered teleology. If you go all the way back to Dante, or if you go back to Aristotle with the prime mover, there was a structure and an order and a teleology that was replete throughout the universe. But with the modern imagination about our cosmos, it's just governed by impersonal laws, impersonal forces, and it would be something akin to what Lewis was arguing in his essay, The Empty Universe, where modern science has quantified and abstracted and has done away with all the mystical, teleological, purpose-filled cosmologies of old, and has replaced it with the bare-bones reductionistic matter and energy sort of paradigms. So I think what you're saying there, Justin, is very close to what Lewis is doing, that we, in order to have a model of the cosmos, whatever it may be, we have to imagine it. We look at the stars and we interpret, and then we make a model. And so I think it's vitally important, because I don't think, you know, and you touch on this, I don't think we stop and realize just how much the imagination informs our understanding of the world, not just of apologetics, but we have to imagine ourselves in a place. Carl Sagan did this years ago with looking at the Earth from Voyager satellite from millions of miles away as a pale blue dot, and that from that perspective on ourselves, we've sort of imagined ourselves as inconsequential and unimportant and insignificant, which is a direct antithesis to the medieval model, where we have significance not because of our topological place on a map in the cosmos, but because we are divine image bearers, created in the image of God. And it requires imagination to consider who we are as image bearers. And so do you see that maybe as you're exploring this topic, that the imagination is necessary for helping us to build a culture of care, as you talk about at the end of the book?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, what you just read from the discarded image makes me think of that scene in another of Lewis's books, The Silver Chair, you know, which follows the story of these children, you know, children in Marsh Wiggle, who go underground into the underworld, and there they are enchanted by a witch who tries to get them to think that the underworld is all that there is. There never was any other world other than her world, right? And so She is enchanting them, but she claims to be disenchanting them. And so she says, well, you know, you think of the sun, you think of a lamp and you think of a bigger, better lamp, and that's the sun. And you think of a cat and you think of a bigger, better cat, and that's Aslan, right? And so she's telling them, you know, it's basically Feuerbach, the German philosopher, who said, you know, basically what we do is we extrapolate from the best of humanity, and that's how we get to God. And we know, those of us who've read the story, that that's actually the opposite of what's happened, that the enchantment or the disenchantment is actually a disciplined forgetting of the way that the world really is. But in either case, it's an imaginative model, right? It's a particular picture of who they are, where they are, and the sort of world that they live in. And, you know, I don't know if you remember in the story, Puddleglum, you know, is fighting the enchantment, and he stomps his foot on the fire to stop the enchantment from taking root in the imaginations of the children and the prince. And he says, we are going to go and spend the rest of our lives looking for the overland, even if there is no overland. But that's no loss if the world is the way that you say it is. And that's what I sort of think of. And there is this sense that when you start with imagination, you also start with this sense of this mechanical world that we are told is all that there is, this world of mechanical and personal processes. In some sense, that feels very unlivable, right? To think that human beings themselves are just a part of a machine, and are no more than the sum of their parts and things like that. And so there is an imaginative impulse, not simply to imagine another world, but also to go in search of another world, to go in search of another way of seeing the universe, which, you know, for Lewis was to reach for that earlier medieval meaning-filled cosmos. But in either case, if you think of sort of the enchantment or disenchantment that we've suffered in the modern world, both of them work on us at the imaginative level, in that we cannot not imagine ourselves connected to our neighbor in a certain way, connected to the earth in a certain way, connected to, you know, the rest of the world in a certain way, because we are part of it. We're part of creation. We're not outside of it. And so that requires us to use our imagination holistically to compose some sort of sense, felt sense of the way that the way that things are.
Would it be fair to say that an impulse that brought about your book might be that apologetics as a formal discipline that is known to many of us as believers, giving a rational defense for the Christian faith, has become kind of has imbibed a kind of modernist assumption about science first principles? I interviewed philosopher of science Paul Tyson a couple of months ago about his book, Theology of Science. Paul is a wonderful interview and just fantastic conversation. But Paul's argument is that we come to the table with this science and faith, science and religion, as if the two are pitted together, and the and clause there is very important. And Paul's saying it should be the opposite. We should be informed first by our Christian theology and try to understand science through the lens of Christianity, through the lens of Christian theology. But instead, what has happened is we've turned the tables, and now we try to understand everything in the world from a completely scientific perspective, whether that's empirical science or social science or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
Did you think that in your research, Justin, that a lot of contemporary apologetics has sort of tacitly imbibed a modernist sense of a kind of a science first dialogue?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot there. So I want to be careful in the way that I unpack this, because I obviously, as a Christian, I do think that, I do think that Christians ought to be working in scientific fields, and the Christian faith can stand up to scientific objections and things like that. But I do think that you're right in saying that I do feel like there's been a reduction of the discipline of apologetics and of the paradigm of knowing, so that what we think of as apologetics, what we might call the traditional way of doing apologetics, is actually pretty recent innovation in apologetics, which was an accommodation to changes in the understanding of how we come to know and what makes something, what makes an argument provable, and even kind of a constraining of rationality to some sort of calculation. Whereas in earlier times, apologetics was much bigger than that. So if you think of the earliest apologists, they were saying a couple of things. I mean, for one thing, they were saying, look at the lives of the Christians. That was the apologetic argument. Look at the way that they love each other. Look at the way they live together. And the other thing that they were saying, if you think of like Justin Martyr, they were saying things like, please, you know, stop killing us. Even if you think that we are wrong, there's no reason to kill us. And so there's this sort of whole embodied tradition of apologetics that is so much more than just, the defense of extracted particular truths. So even though I think that is actually quite important for us to show that, you know, Christians have been thinking about these objections and have good answers, have good responses to many of these things. I think it's a big mistake for us to narrow the discipline of apologetics to this very small slice of what it actually is. So there's this book I've been reading by Ian McGilchrist called The Master and His Emissary. I'm not sure if you've read it, but he's just this brilliant. So he has a neuroscience background, but also a philosophy and literature background. And so the book is really about the hemispheres of the brain and research that they've done into the way that the brain works. And the subtitle of the book is something like, I'm forgetting it now, but The Making of the Western World or something like that. The brain of the making of the Western world. And if I can sort of try to summarize this argument, it's, you know, 600 page book in a short segment, he basically argues that the right hemisphere of the brain is that hemisphere that is grounded in the world, embodied experience of the world. And it's also the thing that integrates all the knowledge that we find. Whereas the left hemisphere is sort of like the emissary. It goes out and tests things and is very interested in control and utility and grasping the world securely. And it seems from the way that the brain is structured that the right hemisphere is meant to be the master and the left hemisphere is meant to be the emissary. So the emissary goes out, reports back to the master, that the master integrates all of the data that the emissary finds into the overall rationality of experience. And he basically argues that over the course of Western civilization, that what has happened is that the emissary has rebelled against the master and has tried to be the one to call the shots, so that it rejects sort of all these other ways of knowing, poetic knowledge, for example, this sort of knowledge that we get from art and music, and that they cannot be found through, you know, rational calculation. And so that has led us to the point where we think that intelligence and artificial intelligence is actually the whole of what intelligence is, right? As if we could reduce intelligence down to what a computer can do and thereby make ourselves think that we are computers. And I think a similar thing has happened with respect to apologetics, where we have sort of, in an attempt to meet modernity on its own ground, we've sort of given up this wider picture of how we come to know the world, how we come to know things. We're not just brains on a stick, right? We are embodied creatures that love and hope and desire and imagine. And there are all these different ways of knowing that are not just the calculation of the rationality. That's why I think that what I'm trying to do in this book is not to abandon, to use McGilchrist's term, not to abandon the left hemisphere sort of testing calculation. It's obviously very, very important. But I'm trying to say this always needs to be placed in this larger project of making a life that is coherent and beautiful, which all of us are engaged in doing. And to do that, you must really pay mm-hmm. attention to the mm-hmm. imagination.
I can't help but share with you that as I'm reading through your book, and I'm sure you've probably had people say this to you already, but it has tinctures of the Apostle Paul on Mars Hill in Acts 17, and specifically a verse kept coming to mind as I'm reading your thoughts on the culture of authenticity that you have derived from Charles Taylor's work. And Paul tells the Athenians, who were all about beauty, I mean, the imaginative constructs of the Greco-Roman world, especially in ancient Greece, where they gave priority to temples and to statues and to the intricate carvings and paintings and the poetry, that early Greece was truly a phenomenal place for philosophy, art, and music to develop. And so when Paul is in front of the Athenians, he's concluding his sermon and he's saying that that they would seek God if perhaps they might grope for him.
Yeah.
I don't know what the Greek there means specifically, but if they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us, and for in him we live and move and exist. And even as some of your own poets have said, we are also his children or his offspring. And so it also brings to mind the idea, Justin, that you have some interesting conversation partners in your book. Schleiermacher, George MacDonald, and Marilynne Robinson, who wouldn't necessarily be on the forefront of a contemporary Christian apologist's mind when it comes to apologetic methodologies. So a couple things here to comment on. Number one, how do you view Paul's thoughts in Acts about your own particular work? And two, why these particular choices of conversation partners for your narrative?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so I love that passage in Acts 17. It's sort of the... The Magna Carta of cultural engagement or something like that, because it does show Paul doing both what Dan Strange would call subversive fulfillment, where it says that you are looking for something and you're absolutely right to do that. And the fact that Paul, first of all, knows the poets well enough to quote them, and then also that he is able to affirm and say they got something right. But at the same time, also to call it into question and to, you know, ultimately, that's where he starts, right? He starts by building that common ground with them. But he also brings them to the point of saying all of these imaginings that you have are challenged by the God who has come to earth in Jesus Christ and lived and died and rose again, and who will be your judge. So to say that we start with imagination does not mean we just sort of imagine whatever we want, or that we imagine God to be however we want God to be, because ultimately all imaginings have to be confronted by the Christian story, the gospel, and by the cross, which is the thing we would never have imagined. And so just to start out by saying that, that's a very important passage, because I think it both shows a very an imaginative generosity and a willingness to start and stay with, but also not to end there. And so I think that that maybe then connects to some of my conversation partners. I can maybe talk about all three of them. Schleiermacher is not a major conversation partner in some ways, because he's sort of this fraught character in the history of theology. What I'm trying to do with Schleiermacher is to say that he got something right, you know, just like Paul would say at Mars Hill. And the thing that he got right is he realized that his contemporaries who had rejected religion and yet were deeply involved in the art world and loved nature, that they actually were going the right direction, and that they had sort of moved into this age of authenticity where a deeply felt personal insight was the thing that was most important to them. And so he, in his speeches to the cultured despisers of religion, was trying to meet them where they were. Now, I think that he went too far in trying to develop an entire rewrite sort of Christian theology by those lights. And so he was wrong in doing that, but he was right in starting there. And so what I try to do in my chapter that's engage a Schleiermacher is I try to ground what he's doing a bit more in Reformed epistemology, Al Plantinga, people like that, and then also thicken it a bit with reference to the church and the necessity of having a believing community that makes the gospel believable. Now, the other two authors, George MacDonald and Marilynne Robinson, one is a 19th century author, one is a contemporary author. Both of them, I think, are interesting because the way that they go about commending the Christian faith is not as a traditional apologist, which, you know, again, as we think of defending the truth claims of Christian faith. MacDonald is really a fascinating figure because he lived at a time where during the Victorian age, which is usually defined as the Victorian crisis of belief. So this was the first time in the English-speaking world that it became sort of socially, publicly acceptable to break up with Christianity. And so there are all these sort of deconstruction stories of, you know, notable Christians breaking up with Christian faith, and people writing autobiographies of losing faith and things like that. And so obviously it's this time where Christian faith is the majority, but it's also very fraught and people are deconverting. And there were apologists in the traditional sense that sort of rose to to defend the Christian faith. But that's not what McDonald did. What McDonald did is he wrote fairy tales and fantasies and realistic fiction novels that embedded this Christian vision within imaginative form. And it was through reading Fantasties, a fairy tale or fantastic tale by McDonald, that Lewis said his own imagination was baptized, though his intellect took a lot longer. So I was very interested in that. So I was interested in McDonald both because of when he worked right at the forefront of what we would now see as secularity, contemporary secularity, where faith becomes sort of this optional thing that you can either believe or not believe. And so right at the beginning, he was working and he picked this very interesting way of doing it that was very engaged with the imagination. He also wrote a really famous essay on the imagination. So there was just a lot there in McDonald. Marilynne Robinson is the Pulitzer Prize winning contemporary writer, who's most well known as sort of a contrarian essayist, but has written, you know, these four very widely read novels, Gilead being her most well known novel, in which she writes through the eyes of faith. And I decided to write a chapter about her because I read this review of Gilead in the New Yorker by an atheist. His name is eluding me, or I think his name is Mark something, but he wrote this review of the book saying, for the first time, I can understand what it would be like to see the world through the eyes of faith, a world that is fallen but loved by its creator. And I was like, that's exactly right. That's exactly what I'm looking for. I want a contemporary writer who is doing this sort of thing, even if, you know, perhaps theologically, I'm not satisfied with all the places she ends up. I am very intrigued by her method of trying to give people the experience of looking through the eyes of faith. And I think she does it really effectively, especially in Gilead and her subsequent novels. So that's how I ended up with those. I think part of also what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to learn from outsiders, because one of the things about the imagination is that it doesn't like familiarity, or it's sort of, if it's something that we feel like we've heard before, it doesn't strike us. You know, it might be something really true or even beautiful, but if we're familiar with it, it doesn't get through to us. And so it has to be a bit slant, right? A bit unfamiliar in order for it to kind of take us by surprise. And I think that happened to me as I read both McDonald and Robinson. And hopefully that also happened to, some of the readers of my book.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. It was a very succinct rundown, Justin, and totally appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit about some contemporary applications, if you will, as you see it, in regards to how, you know, if you had the world according to the way you would want to see it, the practical application of the role of imagination in apologetics. What are we not doing, first of all? I know it's hard to generalize in general about the field of apologetics. It's large and multifaceted, mm-hmm. but what do you think is we're not doing? And number two, what do you think in a general sense, what are some ways in which you would see that this application would extend beyond or into the future of how Christian apologetics is done?
Yeah, great question. I think my hope for the discipline of apologetics would be that it would be a holistic endeavor that includes both reason and imagination, that would include both a robust making of arguments, but also to remember that those arguments are never processed on a flat plane, that they always intersect with people's lives in very particular places. And so I think part of this is, you know, I was a pastor for over a decade and continue to sort of have a pastoral role with college students who are in my office all the time. And the thing that I always think to myself is that defense of the faith always needs to take place under the umbrella of discernment. And what I mean by that, by saying discernment, is discernment asks the question, what's going on, right? What is the Lord doing? What direction is a person moving? And what am I to do, right? In that sense. And if we don't ask that discernment question first, then it easily becomes that apologetics becomes more about winning rather than witnessing. And I think asking the discernment question, taking a moment even to ask yourself, where is this person? Why does this question matter to them? And sometimes that's the question I'll ask a student who's in my office or a person that I meet who has a particular question that they'd like to wrestle with. Can you help me understand why that question matters to you? And just to articulate it so I can hear them say it, so I can kind of get a sense of why it matters to them, because these questions are never processed on a flat plane. So that'd be the first thing that I'd say is a shift from defense and defensiveness to discernment, within which defense would take place. The second thing I'd say, obviously, if we're talking about the imagination, is that we would really need to take beauty seriously. The subtitle of the book is The Beauty of Faith in the Secular Age. And this is not because I'm trying to leave behind the other transcendentals, goodness and truth. Obviously, I think that, you know, you need goodness and truth even to ground beauty. You know, we can judge beauty by its goodness and goodness by its truth. But usually our experience is the opposite. Usually we are led into truth by its goodness and goodness by its beauty, right? And so I think that we have to really take seriously, I think, even the language that we use, whether it's in preaching, whether it's in the way that we are describing the life of faith, to pay attention to the way that a lot of the times our imaginations are captivated, so that a person might say, wow, that's beautiful. It's not true, but it's beautiful, right? Maybe there are some listeners right now who are listening to this and think, oh, well, the Christian faith is beautiful. I don't know if I can get there all the way yet. But if we can even get people to the point where they're desiring that something might be true, then the way that they process arguments is a bit different than, if they're apathetic as to whether or not the truth claims of Christianity are true or not.